All right, so we are holding on Ayin Ches Amud Beis, a little bit past the middle of the Amud. The line begins Tanu Rabbanan, and that's where we're holding. okay, we've been talking about the Inuyim of Yom Kippur, the various things you're not allowed to do. The last one we talked about was Ne'ilas HaSandal, and talking about what is and isn't included in the definition of sandal or of minol or a shoe. Al pi halacha, we ended up with a couple of different possibilities among the Rishonim. The accepted halacha, according to most poskim, is that anything that's not leather is not considered a shoe, and you're allowed to wear it on your paper. So the Gemara says, Tana Rabbanan, Tinoikus Mutarin Bekolan, children are allowed all of these things, besides eating, of course. If they don't eat, it's going to be dangerous to them. All the other things, they're allowed to bathe, they're allowed to smear oil, etc. Chutz min ilas a sandal, with the exception of putting on shoes, leather shoes, that is. So the question is, Maishnon ilas a sandal. So why are we saying leather shoes is not allowed to them? Da'amri inshi avdule. People are going to think that he didn't put them on himself. You know? People are going to think that adults put it on for him. And Rashi refers to, you have an Isser, just like you yourself are not allowed to do lahazir gdolim alaktanim, just like you yourself are not allowed to do Isurim, you're also not allowed to give Isurim to children. It's called lois soichlum, the pasuk says, and we can read the word lois soichlum as if it said lois sa'achilum, you're not allowed to give them to eat, or in this case, to enjoy, to children. So we're saying shoes, the concern is, on the face of it, if the kid is wearing shoes, people are going to think that an adult put them on for him, and therefore they were over on that issue. Well, by that logic also, Hanach Nami, when it comes to bathing and smearing oil, people are going to notice that that was done. Amri Inshi Abulay, people are going to think that adults did it for him rather than realizing that he did it himself. And again, they're going to think that he was over on Lois Sa'achilum. The answer is, Rechitza V'sticha Eimu Me'esmal Abdulay. The answer is, if people see that the child is bathed or has oil smeared on him, it's not going to occur to them necessarily that that was done Davka today on Yom Kippur, and then think that adults were over on this issue of Lois Sa'achilum. They're going to think it was done the day before. It was done on Erev Yom Kippur, when you're allowed to. So the question is then, sandal nami eimer me'esmal abdulei. Nu, can't you say the same thing about shoes? And the answer is, sandal like efshud me'esmal abdulei. They can't put on shoes. The kid is not going to have slept overnight in shoes. De'omar Shmuel, as in fact Shmuel says, it's bad to sleep in shoes. Hai man deboi l'mitam taima demisusa. If a person wants to get a taste of what death is like, L'sayim masoni v'ligni, then let him put on his shoes and go to sleep that way. In other words, it's very bad for you to sleep with your shoes on. So therefore, necessarily, when you see the kid walking around with leather shoes on Yom Kippur, you're going to know that they put them on Yom Kippur. So the question is going to be, did he put them on himself, or did an adult put them on for him? People are going to think that an adult put them on for him, and that he was over on Lois Sa'achilum. Actually, Rabbeinu Yochim says that maybe the vote is, if they see that he's allowed to put it on kids, maybe they're going to think they can do it themselves. So that's what it is. Therefore, so far, what we're saying is, if the kid is wearing shoes, then we have to prevent him, and that means not only we can't put them on him, means if he puts them on himself, we have to tell him no and tell him to take them off. As opposed to Rechitza and Sicha, we're saying on the face of it, you don't need to do that. You can't do them on Yom Kippur itself, but the fact that he goes and you can see that he was bathed and had oil smeared on him is not a problem, because people are going to think that it was done the day before. The problem with that is, the problem with all that is, the Braisa had said that the expression had been Tinoikus Mutorin Bekulon. Children are allowed all these things. So if it was Ein Asurin or something like that, then it would mean, okay, you know, they shouldn't do it L'Hatchila. But yeah, they did that, then fine. But the expression Mutorin implies L'Hatchila. If a person goes to ask the Rav, then the Rav will tell him, give him food and bathe him. So he himself at least is going to know that he did it today. So now you have the problem, what happened to Lois Sa'achilum, or according to Rabbeinu Yochum, what happened to, he's going to think that such things are mutter on Yom Kippur. Why Rashi mentions the point of Hachilehu, by the way, obviously you can feed the kid on Yom Kippur, one point is, in other words, the same way all of the Inuyim kind of go together. If you say that you're allowed to feed him, then you should be allowed to wash him as well. And again, you're allowed to feed him Hachilehu. We're going to talk about later on Daf Pei Beis, Pei Gimel, we're going to talk about we're going to talk about the dinim of how old the kid has to be before they have to start fasting. So we're saying l'chatchila feed him. It sounds like we're saying l'chatchila bathe him as well. But what happened to loy sachilum? Rather the answer is differently. It has nothing to do with whether people are going to think it was done the day before or whether it was done that day. The difference is hanach, when it comes to putting on shoes, delavr v'isayhu, it's not necessary for the child's growth. Therefore, Gazru Bahuraban, and therefore the Chachamim were Gozer that children shouldn't do it either. Children don't have to wear shoes all the time for their normal development. In fact, kids go barefoot, I don't know how much they do nowadays, but at least in the olden days, kids went barefoot a lot of the time. So therefore, it's not strictly speaking necessary for them. So therefore, so if they're putting on leather shoes, then we're going to tell them, take them off. Hanach, the Risayahu, as opposed to when it comes to washing and anointing, which is necessary for their growth, Loy Gozru Rabbanan. The Chachamim were not Gozer on them because just like eating is necessary for the kid's development, he can't go a day without eating. The same way, at least in those times, he couldn't go a day without being bathed and oiled. In fact, the Tosfos Hashanim refers over here to a Gemara in Chulin where Rabbi Yochanan says, or argue so the Gemara say it was Rabbi Hanina, that even when he was old, he was still very strong and vigorous, and he credited that to the hot water and the oil that his mother applied to him when he was little, that still had an effect on him many, many decades later. So we see those things are essential for the child's development. Now, nowadays, by the way, it's not like that. We don't bathe kids every day. Certainly smearing oil, we don't on any kind of regular basis. So therefore, nowadays, this halacha doesn't necessarily apply. Maybe it's one of those things, nishtanu ativim. Maybe it's just practically speaking, we see that a kid develops just fine without it nowadays. So therefore, you can go one day without washing and without being smeared with oil. Anyway, the Amar Abaya, going back to the Gemara, as Abaya says, Omrali Aim, my mother said to me, and the Gemara in Kedushin explains that Abaya's mother passed away in childbirth. So everywhere in Shas where Abaya quotes something from his mother means his foster mother. Anyway, she told me, all over Shas we find she gives medical advice. So she says, Revisi Dianuka, what you need for the proper growth and development of a child is Maya Chamimi Yomishcha. You need hot water to bathe him in and oil to smear on him. Godo Purta, then when the child is a little bit older, you need in addition, Be'asa B'Kutcha, you need to give him eggs in Kutach. Kutach, we know, we learned back in Psachim, we have in other places, is a dip they had in those times made out of sour, out of sour milk and breadcrumbs. And in one place, Rashi says there were moldy breadcrumbs and salt. It was a dip that they used to dip many different kinds of food in. So I guess the idea is, you know, it's got a lot of protein in it. So that together with the egg is good for the child's development. And godo purta, and then when the child is even older than that, taburi money, you have to provide him kalim to break. That's what kids are going to like to do at that age. They like to be disruptive. So you give them kalim to break. As the Gemara gives an example, he heard the Rabba zavin lahu money gzizi de pachra. Rabba would buy already broken, already cracked kalim of cheres. So therefore, they're cheap. Livnei for his children or metabri lahu, and that way they can get out their emotions by breaking them. The reason he bought already cracked ones. So first of all, Rashi says they were cheap. Rabbi Yaakov Emden points out this way also there's no issur of baltashkes. The point is, in other words, that the main point that we're focusing on, though, is the first part of what Abaya's foster mother said, that hot water and oil smearing is essential for a child's development. Therefore, that's something that needs every day. And therefore, you can do that even on Yom Kippur. There is a machlokas among the mafoshim, whether we're talking about over here only a child below the age of chinuch. Are we talking about even a child of the age of chinuch? There's also, of course, the complication that if you yourself bathe him, then you yourself are putting your hands in water on Yom Kippur, and that itself you're not allowed to do. So either it would mean you'd have to be doing it using gloves, or again, it could mean the kid is doing it on his own and you're not stopping him. which again, you know, we're saying there is a concept of chinuch, but if it's necessary for the child development, then we're saying he can do it himself. Another possibility the post can talk about is maybe having a goy do it. What are the pros and cons of that? Okay. The Mishnah had said, Hamelech v'hakala yuchatzu espneyem. The Mishnah had said that an exception to the rule that you're not allowed to wash yourself on Yom Kippur is that a king or a kala are able to wash their faces. And we said in the Mishnah as follows. We said a king and a kala can wash their faces. A woman who just gave birth is allowed to wear leather shoes because the cold is bad for her. Then the Mishnah had said, Dibur Rabbi Eliezer v'chachamim oisrim. So the question now is, masnisin mani, who is our Mishnah like? There's two ways that Rishonim have of explaining the question. One is, are the Chachamim in fact arguing on Rabbi Eliezer on all three things, or are they maybe only arguing on the case of wearing the shoes? Maybe they would agree that the king and the kala can wash their faces for reasons that we're going to say in a second. So that's one way of understanding the question. The other way of understanding the question is, when the Mishnah says that Rabbi Eliezer allows all three things, does everybody agree that Rabbi Eliezer allows all of them, or are there maybe other Tanoim who hold that Rabbi Eliezer that Rabbi Eliezer himself would not accept all of these things? So the Gemara says Rabbi Hanani ben Tradin. Our Mishnah then is according to Rabbi Hanani ben Tradin. The Tanya, we learn in a Braisa, a Melech v'akala lo yuchatzu espneyem. Rabbi Hanani ben Tradin, I'm Mishnah Rabbi Eliezer, a Melech v'akala yuchatzu espneyem. So Braisa says a king and a kala are not allowed to wash their faces, but Rav Hanani ben Tzadian says in the name of Rabbi Eliezer that they can. And Chayat Loitinul Sasandal, a woman who just gave birth is not allowed to be wearing shoes. Rav Hanani ben Tzadian, Omer Mishum Rabbi Eliezer, Chayat Tinul Sasandal. And again, Rav Hanani ben Tzadian says that Rabbi Eliezer says you can. So again, according to the two different explanations over here, either this establishes, therefore, that our Mishnah, when it says Rabbi Eliezer allows all of them, is only according to Rabbi Hanani ben Tradian. The other Chachamim of Rabbi Hanani ben Tradian's generation might disagree and say that Rabbi Eliezer himself does not allow these things, and therefore our Mishnah that says Rabbi Eliezer does would be according to Rabbi Hanani ben Tradian's version. Or the other possibilities we see from this Braisa, that the Chachamim again of Rabbi Eliezer's generation disagree with him on all three things. Not like you might think from a superficial reading of the Mishnah that maybe they only disagree on the last one about the woman who just gave birth wearing shoes. Okay, so the Gemara says my timer. Now, why should a king be allowed to wash his face? The reason is because the pasuk says you should see the king in his beauty. In other words, you always have to have fear for the king, and in order to do that, that requires that everybody always sees him at his best. For that reason, the Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin, the king has to take a haircut every day. So here, the idea is he has to wash his face every day. Kala my timer. What about a kala? Why is she allowed to? And the reason is shalot kadesh letis gana al baila, so she doesn't look unattractive to her husband. Which we talked about in the Mishnah, what the Mishnah Berurah says, that nowadays that people spend pretty much the whole day in shul anyway, then there's no real tisgana al baila if she doesn't wash her face, and therefore we don't really have that head. Amalei Rav l'Rabchia. So Rav asked Rabchia, kala ad kama. When we say that a kala is allowed to wash her face, for how long is she considered a kala? Amalei, so he answers Kidatanya. Like we learn in a braisa in a different context, you have a braisa that it talks about in Ksubas. You have a case where they're getting ready for the wedding. Everything's already prepared. And then the father of the chassan or the mother of the kala passes away. Now, the point is, the Gemara says over there, the father of the chassan is usually the one who makes most of the wedding arrangements for his son. The mother of the kala does the same thing for her daughter. So therefore, now, if we tell them to delay the wedding because of the avelos, then they're not going to have anybody who's going to be able to work on the wedding as well as their parent who just passed away. Therefore, the Gemara tells us over there, we allow them to go through with the wedding and even to have their first relations, the Be'ilas Mitzvah, only then do they separate and they keep the seven days of Sheva Brachas. They celebrate the 7 days of Sheva Brachas, and only then afterwards do they have the 7 days of Avelos. The point is, the Braisa quotes over there, Ein moinin tachshit min akala kol shloshin yom. Nevertheless, even though the kala is an oval in this case, if her mother passed away, we don't prevent her from wearing any of her cosmetics or any of her jewelry for all those 30 days. So we see therefore that she's considered a kala, and we want her to be attractive to her husband until 30 days have passed. After that, they're used to each other. So therefore, if he doesn't see her at her best, then it's not going to make such a difference. Now, this that the Gemara is asking for the reason behind the king and for the amount of time for the kala, that seems to imply that the halacha is like Rabbi Eliezer. Otherwise, why would the Gemara bother with that? And in fact, most of the Rishonim do paskin like Rabbi Eliezer, even though usually Yochid V'Rabim, halacha K'Rabim, in this case, they paskin like Rabbi Eliezer on the strength of the fact that the Gemara is asking for practical, in this case, with the kala, for the practical outcome of it, for how long is she considered a kala. There are a couple of the Rishonim who say that maybe the halacha should rather be like the Chachamim and the kala is not allowed to. Again, nowadays, at least as far as the kala, it's a bit of a moot point because nowadays everybody spends their day in shul anyhow. What about, we said Hachaya Tinilas a sandal. We said that a woman who just gave birth is allowed to wear leather shoes. And the reason is Mishum Tsina. The reason is because the cold is bad for her. Again, nowadays, that's not necessarily so applicable because nowadays we have perfectly good warm shoes of other materials available. But back then, that was the only way for her to keep her feet warm. So Amar Shmuel, Im Machmas Sakonis Akrav, Shmuel says, here's another din, though. If you have to wear leather shoes because there's a place where you have to be concerned that there are scorpions there and they might bite you, mutter, then anybody is allowed to wear shoes, leather shoes, when they're walking through such an area. Now, obviously, it was a matter of pekuach nefesh. There's no chiddush in it. The point is, in other words, why do you have to go in that place in the first place? Go someplace else where there aren't any scorpions. Or some of the mafarshim say the point is, even if there's only a suffix, whether there's scorpions there, Rashi uses the expression. In fact, makom sheyesh lochush lakrabim, a place where you have to be concerned about scorpions. So, in other words, either the chiddush is that even if you don't know for sure that there are scorpions there, you're allowed to. Or the point is that you're allowed to walk through the area even though there are scorpions there, and that means you're going to have to wear leather shoes rather than you might have said the Chachamim should say, look, don't go in that area, don't go in that area in the first place, and you won't have a problem. Okay. Next, we said in the Mishnah, ha'oicho k'cheseves hagasa. We said if a person eats food the size of a large date, Then he's over on the Isurim of Yom Kippur, and b'mezid is chayiv kodesh, and b'shogeg he would have to bring a chatas. So boy the papa. So the papa wants to know k'cheseves sha'amru b'garinosa b'loy garinosa. Does this mean a k'cheseves including its pit or without its pit? Now the Mishnah had used the expression k'moyo garinosa, like the date and with it and its pit. So therefore the question was, so Rashi explains the question. Does it mean the size of the date including its pit, or does it mean the size of the date or of its pit? Meaning, in other words, as the Gemara is going to discuss soon, the question: what do you have more of? Do you have more flesh of the fruit, or do you have more pit? Obviously, I guess it depends on the type of date, but on the size of the date relative to its pit. But the Gemara is going to talk about later. Whether the volume of the flesh of the fruit is more, or whether the volume of the pit is more. Right now, Rav Papa is assuming, according to Rashi, that when the Mishnah says kamoyo garinosa, conceivably it might mean that it's the size of the flesh of the date or the size of the pit of the date, that those two things are equal. So that's the question. Or does it mean the size of the flesh plus the pit? And it was the whole thing together as it comes naturally. Tosfos has a lot of problems with Rashi's explanation of that. And they explain that actually one possibility is when the Mishnah had said Kaisevas Hagasa, Kamoya, Uchgarinosa, maybe it meant the size of a date as it comes naturally with the pit inside, plus another pit of a second date. So it would be, in other words, so it would be essentially the size of 1.5 dates. So is that what it means, or does it just mean the one date by itself with its own pit and nothing more? Then Tosfos also brings, based on Yerushalmi, that another question is, when you look at a date, when you open up a date, you find there's a space between the pit and the flesh of the fruit. Unlike you have a lot of fruits where the flesh is tightly attached to the pit. A date is not like that. You have a little bit of space in there. So the question is, does that space count towards it, or do you maybe flatten out the date in order to get rid of that space, and then you measure it that way? So that's another way that Tosfos says to explain your Papa's question. Similarly, the Gemara says, "Boy, Rav Ashi." Rav Ashi had a similar question. Now, the Gemara is going to explain in a second that Rav Ashi does not have a problem with the Kaseves. He knows that it means with the pit, as we're going to discuss in a second. But he has a different question. When we say Etzem Kisaira, we say that a piece of bone the size of a grain of barley is enough to be metame a person who touches it or who carries it. So the question is, when we say the size of a barley grain, what do we mean? The klipasa or below klipasa? Do we mean the barley grain with its shell, barley, wheat and barley and other grains like that come inside a husk, inside a shell? So does it include that? Or below klipasa? Or does it mean without the husk? And balacha or biyavesha? Are we talking about a fresh grain of barley, which is larger, or a dry one, which is smaller? So the Gemara points out, Rav Ashi lo miboy lo hod Rav Papa. Now, Rav Ashi didn't have a question, didn't have to ask Rav Papa's question. He knew that the Kaseves of our Mishnah includes the pit, or according to Tosfos' explanations, it includes the extra pit, or it includes the space, because, after all, gasa itmar, because Rav Ashi takes the view, the Mishnah says the expression Kaseves ha-gasa, which means a large date, so therefore, kol kama degasa. So the bigger it is, the bigger you want the biggest one possible. That would be the shear for eating. We're going to explain later on why it is, why we're going to explain in a few lines, why it is that the shear is kesevis agasa anyway, rather than usually when we say you're not allowed to eat something in halacha, usually it's a kesayis. But the point is, Rav Ashi takes the view, since it says kesevis agasa, so it means the biggest kesevis possible. Conversely, Rav Papa lemi boya lehoder Rav Ashi, Rav Papa did not have Rav Ashi's question about the etzim kisa'ura, because he figures, obviously it has to be that it's dry. Lacha shibolus mikri. If it was still fresh, it wouldn't be called sa'ura, it would be called shibolus, which are a stalk of grain. So therefore, obviously, if we're saying kisa'ura, it has to be in dry one. And shaloi b'kliposa ushla mikri, and a peeled grain of barley without its husk is not called sa'ura either. It goes by a different name. It goes by the name ushla. So therefore, if it was a shear is etzim kisa'ura, then it must mean, we're talking about a dry grain of barley still in its husk, and that would be what we're considering the size of a sa'ura. For that purpose, where a piece of bone that size would be metame a person. Okay. Getting back now to the Kaseves, Omar Rava, Omar of Yehuda, Rava says, or Rava it says on the side, it says in the name of Rabbi Yehuda, Kaseves hagasa sh'omri yisera mekabeta. This kaseves hagasa that we're talking about in our Mishnah is larger than a kabeta. So not only is it larger than a kazayas, it's even larger than a kabeta. Now we're going to have on, that's not the last word on it, we're going to have on Omid Beis a different opinion of Rav Zvid that says that it's smaller. But first let's deal with Rav Yehuda's opinion, that it's larger than a kabeta. So now the question is, in that case, why is the minimum shear of eating on Yom Kippur that makes a person chayav, why is it so large? Usually when it comes to eating in halacha, we usually say kezayis. The reason is, he says, v'kimlohu l'rabbanon, the chachamim know as a fact, d'bahachim yas v'dayte, only that amount is going to settle the person's mind. In other words, when it comes to Yom Kippur, it never actually says don't eat on Yom Kippur. What it says is to anuos nafshei seichem, asher lo se'une, that you don't feel afflicted. The Chachamim figured out that a person still feels afflicted, a person still feels hungry until he eats a kaseves hagasa, which according to Rabbi Yehuda now we're saying is larger than a kabeza. If we figure a kabeza is, now you actually have, at the end, we'll talk about what, practically speaking, what this comes out to in measurements nowadays. Rabbi Avraham Chaim Nur calculates that a kabeza by itself would be about 2 ounces. You also have, sometimes we talk about a beitza without its shell, and you have to factor that in as well. He calculates that a beitza without its shell is about 3/4 of that. So therefore it comes out to about 1.5 ounces or an ounce and 2/3 or something like that. So according to Rabbi Yehuda, only if you eat a little more than that are you actually going to feel not maybe satisfied, but it'll take the edge off your hunger, and now you won't feel afflicted anymore. But less than that, the person is not going to feel, it's not going to take the edge off his hunger. We'll talk about in the Gemara tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem, I mean, how do you apply that across the board to all people? Don't different people have different size appetites? We'll take up that point, and we'll take up that point on Daf Pei, Be'ez Hashem. But right now, that's the idea. In other words, once a person eats a keseves, a gasa, then he doesn't feel inui anymore. So the Gemara asks Meisvi, I have a contradiction. So you're telling me that a keseves agasa is larger than a kebetza. Let's look at a Mishnah in Sukkah, which we'll be learning in more detail in a few weeks, Be'ez Hashem, because the next Masechta after this one. The Mishnah says, Meisvi hebiu l'Rabban Yechon ben Zakkai litem es atavshel. It happened once they brought Rabban Yechon ben Zakkai a little bit of food from a stew to taste. And litim as a tabshal actually could also mean that they gave him a little bit of bread to go along with it also. Ulam Gamliel shtek hisavas of lishamayim. They brought Rabbi Gamliel 2 dates and a bucket of water. And even though you're not required to eat such things in the sukkah, but Amru halum la sukkah, Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai told them, bring it up to the sukkah. The expression bring it up, Rashi explains over there, is because they usually used to build their sukkahs on their roofs. So the normal way was you'd bring it up. So the point is, they were machmer on themselves. The Gemara explains over there, the chiddush of that is that even though you're not required to eat such small amounts, or as the Gemara is going to say soon, fruit, outside the sukkah, nevertheless, a person wants to be machmer on themselves. It's not considered yuhara. It's not considered that they're showing off, look how careful in mitzvahs I am. So you're allowed to do that. The Tony Allah, so we learn in a braisa. Loy mipnei shehalocha kach. It's not because the halacha is technically that they have to eat such things in the sukkah. Ela shadotzu lahachmer alatzman. They want to be machmer on themselves. Fine. But then the Mishnah continues. Uchshenosna lo the Reb Tzadik oichel pochas mikabetza. On the other hand, when they gave Reb Tzadik food less than a kabetza, and at this point we're assuming that it could be any kind of food. It could be fruit. It could be bread. It could be whatever. Nitoloi b'mapa, he took it in a cloth, meaning, so he did 3 kolos with it. Nitoloi b'mapa, v'acholoi chutz l'suka, v'loi beirach achrav. He took it in a cloth, and instead of washing his hands, he ate it outside the sukkah, and he didn't make a brach achroina. So the 3 kolos are, he didn't wash his hands, he just wrapped his hands in a cloth. Rashi over here says, the reason is because of delicacy, because you don't want to eat with dirty hands. Tosfos gives a different reason. Reb Tzadik was a Kohen, and therefore, so if he eats truma with his bare hands, then he's going to make a tummy. A person's hands without washing them are sheni l'truma d'rabbanon. And if he picks up the food with his bare hands, then he's going to be metame it because it's truma. So therefore, normally he would have to wash his hands for that. But over here, instead of washing his hands, he wrapped them in a cloth. Part of the point is, there is a machlokas rishonim. Everybody agrees that for food to transmit truma to something else, you need a kabetza. And here, as we say in the Mishnah, we're talking less than a kabetza. But for food itself to become tameh, do you need a kabetza as well or not? Rashi and Tosfos discuss that point in several different places in Shas. The Rambam holds that food can be metameh any amount and only to be metameh, or can become tameh in any amount and only to be metameh others. Do you need a kabetza? Tosfos discusses in several places the possibility that maybe food can become tameh by itself less than a kabetza. So that would also bear on this over here, whether we're saying that he had to walk, that he wrapped his hands in a cloth instead of washing. Was it just for cleanliness, or was it because of dinim of tumah v'tahara? Anyway, so that's kula number one. Kula number two is that he ate it outside the sukkah, which we're saying you allowed to. And the point is, the Gemara says over there, don't think that if a person does that, you should think, oh, look at him, he's being careless with mitzvahs, because we see that Reb Tzadik did that. And number three, that he didn't make a bracha achrona, is because, as we're going to learn later on in the sugya, that according to Rabbi Yehuda, only if you eat a kebetza do you need to make a bracha. Do you need to bench or make a bracha achrona? And in this case, it was less than a kebetza. Tosfos over here gets into a long discussion about the pros and cons of that. Is the halacha in fact like that, or rather, is the halacha like Rabbi Meir that you have to bench even if you only ate a kezias? Okay. Anyway, the point is that we're contrasting what Rabbi Gamliel did with his 2 dates versus what Rabbi Tzadik did with food less than a kebetza, implying ha kebetza boi sukkah. Now, the implication seems to be that if he had eaten a kebetza, then he would have had to eat it in the sukkah. So therefore, obviously, when we said before that Rabbi Gamliel ate two dates outside the sukkah, at this point, we don't have a reason to think that there's a difference between dates versus bread or anything else. We would assume that any food that you eat in the size of a kibbutz has to be done in the sukkah. So now, if Rabbi Yehuda is telling us that a kesevis itself is larger than a kibbutz, then obviously two kesevis is much larger than that. The Gemara is also assuming that the kesevis they brought Rabbi Gamliel are kesevis hagasa, or even if not, fine. I mean, they may not have been kesevis hagasa, but at least two of them together has to probably be more than the volume of one kesevis hagasa. So if you're going to say that a kesevis agasa is larger than a kibbutz, then what do you mean that Rabbi Gamliel is only being machmer on himself to eat it in the sukkah, and he didn't technically need to? Why not? If even two kesevis without their pits, now obviously Rabbi Gamliel is not eating the pits, but fine, if even two of them together without the pit doesn't add up to a kibbutz, how do you have that one of them with the pit is over a kibbutz? The Gemara is assuming at this point that the pit is smaller than the flesh. So necessarily, therefore, you're going to end up, therefore, that Rabbi Gamliel, according to Rabbi Yehuda's way of looking at it, Rabbi Gamliel was eating less than a kibbutz because we're saying he ate two dates. Without the pits, fine, but still, so if that doesn't even add up to a kibbutz, and therefore the only reason he's eating it in the sukkah is to be machmer on himself, then how do you have that one together with its own pit is going to equal more than a kibbutz, like Rabbi Yehuda is saying? Okay, I mean, Tosfos Hashanim asks the question that the fact is maybe the implication is not so much about eating in the sukkah versus not. Maybe the point is we're contrasting with Reb Tzadik, who didn't wash for it. In other words, maybe the question is that how much you need until a sudayim for versus being able to wrap up your hands. Tosfos Hashanim leaves the question unanswered. Acharonim talk about a couple of possibilities. One of them being that since the Mishnah is contrasting what Rabbi Tzadik did with what Rabbi Gamliel did in all three ways, so the implication is there's also a contrast as far as the dinim of sukkah, which is what we're focusing on over here, where Rabbi Gamliel would hold that a kibbutz does require to eat it in the sukkah less than a kibbutz does not. Whereas Reb Tzadik would hold less than a kibbutz does not require the sukkah. Rabbi Gamliel would hold that even less than that, he wants to be machmer on himself. So therefore, again, so on the face of it, what he ate is less than a kibbutz. Otherwise, there's nothing to talk about. He would have to eat in the sukkah. The answer is Amar Rabbi Yumia. So Rabbi Yumia answers Ein. As a matter of fact, you could say yes. You could answer that yes. Two dates without their pits, and obviously that's how Rabbi Gamliel is eating them because he's not eating the pits, would amount to less than a kibbutz of food. But once you add in the pit, then you have, even with one kesevis, then yes, you end up with more than a kibbutz. The pit, in other words, is larger, or at least as large as the flesh. Amar Papa, Hainu Damri Inchi. So the Papa says, this bears out the expression that people say, Tre Kabi de Tamri, if you have two kavim of dates, you should know you're not getting two kavim worth of food out of them. You have the dates are with their pits. You end up with Chad Kaba de Kashiosa, you end up with one kav of pits, or Sriach, and a little more than a kav. In other words, the pits are even larger than the flesh. Now, obviously, it's going to depend on the type of date. I guess we're talking about the cultivar of date that they had at that time and place. Nowadays, when you buy dates in the store, not always are they like that. Many times you have more flesh than pit. But the ones they had in those days, I guess the point is, Rabbi Papa is telling us that you have there's more pit than flesh, or maybe actually the pit is exactly equal to the flesh. What we said before, also there's the space, there's the hollow space a little bit between the pit and the flesh. So you come out with there's more pit than flesh over there. So you could say then that one kesevis, including its pit, equals, according to Rabbi Yehuda, more than a kibbutz, whereas if you were to take out the pit, then you have less than half a kibbutz, and therefore, even if you have two of those, you're still not up to a kibbutz yet. Rava Omar, Rava gives a different answer. You don't have to say necessarily that the pit is larger than the flesh. Hasam Hainu Taima, the reason why over there Rav Gamliel did not have to eat it in the sukkah, and it's just that he was being machmer on himself, is Mishum Dahabu like Peri, because we're talking about fruit. Or Peri, like Bo'u Sukkah. Eating fruit is not something you have to do in the sukkah. You only need to eat in the sukkah when you're having a suddah with bread or mezonos at least. Fruit is not like that, and therefore you don't have to. Mephoshim explained that what Rabbi Huda Mephoshim explained that what Rava means by that, and what does he have to tell us that it's fruit? Of course we know that dates are fruit. The point is, even though this is fruit from Shiva Saminim, and those are more important, and in fact in Brachas, Rav Gamliel himself tells us that you have to say that you have to bench on fruit from Shiva Saminim. Nevertheless, even he would agree that as far as the dinim of sukkah, you only have to eat in the sukkah if you're eating bread or mezonos, but not fruit, not even fruit from the Shiva Seminim. So the Gemara says, Mesvi, I have a contradiction. What do you mean that you're allowed to eat fruit outside the sukkah? Amar Rebbe, and Rebbe says, Kreinu loimnim Torah etzah Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua. When we used to learn Torah by Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua, Rebbe learned by many of the different Chachamim of his generation, and one of the Gemara actually mentions, there is actually a Gemara in Yevamos where Rebbe says on himself that I went to Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua's yeshiva, but his Talmidim were very harsh with me, and they didn't allow me to learn very much over there, and he says I only learned one din b'mishnah senu. But that means, in other words, so it can mean that he only learned one din in Mishnayos, but he learned lots of other things of Braises and Gemara and whatever. Anyway, so there was a period of time when he was a Talmud by Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua. So he viewed the Fanenu Te'enim Vanovim. They brought us figs and grapes, which are fruit. We ate them as a snack outside the sukkah. So we see achilas arai ein achilas kevaloi. So you see that if you're having a snack of them, you should be allowed to. But if you eat a real full meal, if you make a kvius of them, then you're not allowed to. So what are you, Rava, telling us that fruit, regardless, you're allowed to eat outside the sukkah? It sounds based on this bright, so like only if you're eating at a snack. The answer is Ema, you can say what Rebbe means is achalim ka achilas arai chutz l'sukkah. What it means is we ate them like a snack. In other words, the very fact that the very fact that it's fruit makes it considered automatically a snack. So even if they actually sat down and they had a kvius, they're going to sit, they're going to recline together, they're whatever, and they're going to sit there and eat fruit. Nevertheless, that would be considered achilas arai, and they're allowed to do that outside the sukkah. Or another possibility. What he can mean is achalam achilas keva. We did eat the fruit as achilas keva, but it wasn't just fruit. Together with them, we ate bread, where that was just a snack. We didn't sit with a kvius for the bread. Primarily, we were eating fruit. The bread was just to help the fruit go down. And all of that was so. The first answer is achalam ka achilas arai chutz l'sukkah. We ate it like an achilas arai, meaning the very fact that it's fruit is an achilas arai. The second answer is achalam achilas keva va'achalnu pas achilas arai ba'adayu. Together with them, we ate bread as achilas arai, and all of that was chutz l'sukkah, outside the sukkah. Because again, fruit, there's no question. You know, according to the second explanation, fruit, there's no question that you don't have to eat in the sukkah, even if you're eating it as achilas keva. And number two is that, and the point is, even you're accompanying it with bread, but the bread is achilas arai, so you're eating less than a kibetza, less than a kazayis, or a kibetza of bread, then you're also allowed to eat it outside the sukkah. So it could mean that, and therefore that's no contradiction on Rava that says that fruit you don't have to eat in the sukkah, which in fact is the halacha. You don't have to eat, technically, you only have to eat bread and mezonos in the sukkah. You have, we are, our minhag is to be machmer and not to eat or drink anything outside the sukkah, but based on what we're saying in the Gemara over here, that's a chumrah, that's not the ikir adin. The Gemara says, Lema Messiah, in that case, can we say that we can support what Rava is saying, that fruit never requires to be eaten in a sukkah, even if you eat it as achilas keva? Can we support what Rava is saying from a braisa as follows? The Mishnah talks about over there in sukkah that Rabbi Eliezer says you have to eat 14 meals during sukkahs in the sukkah. In other words, according to him, the mitzvah of sukkah is accomplished by eating a full meal twice a day in the sukkah. Whereas the Chachamim disagree and say only on the first night are you required to, the rest of the time in principle, if you want to live off snacks and not have to eat in the sukkah at all, then the Chachamim say you're not required to. The halacha is like the Chachamim. But anyway, Rabbi Eliezer says you have to have these 14 meals, and he says lefichach, therefore, since you have to have 14 meals, im hishlam mine tagima, if he completed the 14 meals, so he didn't eat all of them as meals of bread or mezonos, instead he made some of them up with mine tagima, which Rashi over here translates taugima as lifton, as side dishes, things that you would eat together with bread, like condiments and things. Tosfos brings from Rashi and Sukkah, who explains it differently. It includes things like fruits and toasted grain and cooked leeks and things like that, which, in other words, also things like that a person would eat for dessert. Anyway, so Yotza, then Rabbi Eliezer says he's Yotza, his chiyuv of one of the 14 meals. Now, if you're going to tell me that fruit requires sukkah, before we had what Rava said, where we thought that fruit does require eating in the sukkah as long as you're eating more than a shiur of it, and only Rava was machadish to us that not, if you were going to say like that, then listen peiris, then why would the braisa be using the word mine tagima? It could use the word fruit instead. So therefore, isn't that a proof to Rava that fruit never requires a sukkah? And therefore, in other words, fruit is never considered a sudas keva. And therefore, that brings us back to Rava's point, therefore, that you never need to eat fruit in the sukkah. Even if you are eating as a chilas keva, it still has the din of achilas arai. Because we see the braisa does not bring fruit. Instead, it talks about mine tagima. The Gemara says that's not a solid proof. Because first of all, my mine tagima peiris. First of all, the word mine tagima could mean fruit. Instead of, like we said, that it means condiments or desserts or things like that, it could conceivably mean fruits. The borisema, or another possibility, the braisa could be talking about asra de l'shikipari in a place where you don't have very commonly found fruit. Now, we don't mean you don't find food at all. There's almost no place in the world where you're never going to have fruit. It means that you don't have shivas aminim. As we said before, shivas aminim have a special status of their own. So you could have argued maybe if there are shivas aminim, maybe in fact those would be considered a kviris. Because the chiddush is that even though you don't have them, but all you have is mine tagima, Rabbi Eliezer considers that acceptable to make up some of the 14 meals. And therefore, that's not up. So therefore, we can't necessarily prove from that Rava's point that fruit is never considered a sudas keva. Maybe in fact fruit would be considered a sudas keva if that fruit from the shivas aminim, at least if such fruit is available. But in a place where no such fruit is available, then you can fall back on mine tagima. Okay. So all of that was all according to Yehuda's opinion, that a keseves agasa is larger than a kebetza, so therefore we had to see how that reconciles with the Mishnah and Sukkah. Now we have a second opinion, Rav Zvid Amar, no, keseves agasa or sh'amru chaserem a kebetza. The keseves agasa that we're talking about is smaller than a kebetza. Now, maybe not much smaller, because we don't want to have, there's too much of a machloikas between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Zvid, but at least that instead of being slightly larger than a beitza, he says it's slightly smaller than a beitza. And how do we know that, says Rabbi Zvid, it's not. Because we learn in the first Mishnah of Masech the Beitza, which we'll be getting to this around Rosh Hashanah time, Be'ez Hashem, the Mishnah starts out over there with three machlokes in where unusually Bishamay is Makel and Bishil is Machmir, the opposite of how it usually is. One of them is that Bishamay holds to be over on Isur Bal Yeroa Bal Yemotze on Pesach. If a person has Sa'ur, which is sourdough, then he's over if he has a Kazayas. But if he has chometz, which is not sourdough, then he's over only if he has kekeseves, only if he has the size of a date. Whereas Basil says both of them is a kezais. Vahavinanba, now we discuss over there in the Gemara in Beitza, my time of the Bishamai, why does Bishamai say that there's a difference between chometz and sa'ur, and why do they say the shear of sa'ur is, and why do they say the shear of sa'ur is smaller and of chometz is larger? So they say, because nichne v'rachmana chometz v'le boi sa'ur, because after all, what does the pasuk say? Lo yeroa l'cha chometz, v'lo yeroa l'cha sa'ur. So why did the pasuk have to say both of them? Why did it have to say chometz and sa'ur? It could have just said chometz, and we would understand sa'ur from it. Or some of the mepharshim explain that the question is not that maybe it had to say both of them, because after all, sa'ur is not edible. But it could have said them in one lab. It could have said lo yeroa l'cha chometz u'sa'ur, rather than putting them as two separate ones. Lo yeroa l'cha chometz, v'lo yeroa l'cha sa'ur. So it could have said one without the other, or it could have said them both in the same lab, and we would have understood va'anami. You know, we would realize with a kavachomer that once you're not allowed to have chometz around, you're not allowed to have sur either. Uma chometz she'en chimutzei kosher, ma the chometz where the chometzness of this is not so strong. After all, chometz is not able to make other things chometz. Where the chometz is a bread or something, it's not able to make other things chometz. And yet, so it's chimutz, its ability to make other things chometz is very weak. And yet also kazayis, and yet it's also to have a kazayis of it around. So then, how much more so sa'ur, where the chometzness of it is much stronger, it has the capability of making something else chometz. So therefore, so on that grounds alone, we would realize that sa'ur can't be any more lenient than chometz. Now Rashi explains. Obviously, what it is if we had to learn sa'ur from chometz, then we couldn't say that sa'ur has a smaller shear, because we would say daya levamin adin lias kenod. And if we're going to make a kavachomer, we can't make the thing that we're learning by the kavachomer stronger than the one we're learning from. So we would say chometz presumably has a larger shear. Sa'ur therefore would also have to have a larger shear. So therefore, the Torah writes sa'ur separately to tell us even a kazayis is chayav. Now, why don't we say sa'ur, a person is chayav for less than a kazayis? Rashi says, because after all, listen, I mean, even eating, we're only going to say a person is chayav for eating chometz on Pesach only if he eats a kazayis. Because in general, when the Torah tells us not to eat, then it means a kazayis. So you're not going to say that re'iyah, you're not going to say bal yaroh, bal yamotzeh, you're not going to say that that's stronger than eating, and therefore a person should be chayav for less than a kazayis. Necessarily, therefore, that means sa'ur is a kazayis. And since it puts sa'ur and chometz separately, and therefore, in other words, so we're not meant to learn sa'ur from chometz with a kavachomer, so that must mean that sa'ur has the shear of a kazayis, but therefore chometz must have a larger shear. So we would have said sa'ur shechmutzei kosher loy kosher again. Therefore, midipalginu rachmana, since the Torah divides them up and says sa'ur and chometz separately, and since obviously, so and again, if it had said them together, we still would have known that sa'ur is osur. We just would have thought the shear is the same as chometz because daya levamin adin, and we would have said this kenodin, and we would have said both of them are kazayis. Now that the Torah is separating them out, then it means that sa'ur b'kazayis for chometz b'kakasevitz. Therefore, they say it means that sa'ur, you need only a kazayis, which is the minimum shear for anything to be osur. Chometz, therefore, must have to be a larger amount, namely a kakasevitz. Okay, the question is, why a kesevis? Why not various other fruits? So Tosfos says, okay, because listen, once we're saying it has to be larger than a kazayis, then we use the shear of Yom Kippur that we're saying over here, because it's a similar kind of thing. Where there's an isser, rather than a gregeris, you don't really have a gregeris. You have specifically when it comes to carrying food on Shabbos, that if a person carries out food the size of a gregeris on Shabbos, they're chayev. Other than that, we don't really find gregeris used as a shear in halacha. So how does that relate to our point, says Rav Zvid? The Isakudaida Kasevis Agasa Shaomri Yusaida Bakabeza. If you're gonna tell me, like you said, Rav Yehuda, that a Kasevis Agasa of our Mishnah is even larger than a Kabeza, well, Mechti Beshamaya Shiur the Nafish Mikazayas Kamahadri. Now let's see, Beshamaya is trying to find the next larger shear after a Kazayas. So okay, Gregeris they're not using for the reasons that we just said that Tosfos quotes, but the next larger one should be if a Kasevis is larger than a Kabetza, Lisni Kabetza, then they should say that the shear for Chometz is a Kabet, for Bayura Bayamatza is a Kabetza. The inami kihadori ninu, or even if you were going to argue that a keseves and an egg are the same size, then also nisni kabetza, then fine, it could still use the word kabetza, which is a much more common thing than keseves. Keseves you really only find in connection with Yom Kippur. So if you were to say that, so how can you say that a kesevis is larger than or even equal to an egg? In that case, then why is Beshami not mentioning an egg instead? Obviously, therefore, says Rav Zvid, a kesevis must be smaller than a kabeta. And therefore, so that's the next larger thing than a kazayis. So therefore, Bishamay is saying, given that chometz has to be a larger amount than sa'ur, because again, otherwise the Torah wouldn't have had to specify chometz and sa'ur separately. We would have learned sa'ur by a kavachomer from chometz, which by the way, the Gemara explains over there, but Hillel disagrees with that kavachomer because they say sa'ur and chometz each has a feature that the other one doesn't have, we'll get to that in Masechta Beitza around Rosh Hashanah time, Be'ez Hashem. Anyway, the point is, going back to Beis Shammai, obviously the point is, Beis Shammai is saying, given that chometz has to have a larger shear than Sa'ur, Sa'ur we said is a kezias, because that's the minimum amount for a person ever to be chayav for. You can't make it stronger than eating, which is a kezias. Therefore, it follows that Beis Shammai is looking for the next larger size. If we're going to say that the next larger size is a kedetza, according to Rabbi Huda, then that's what they should be saying. Instead, they're saying a kesevis, implying that a kesevis is the next larger size, and therefore that's smaller than a kedetza. So the Gemara says, Mimai, who says that's a valid proof? You could maybe say that the kesevis agasa of Omnish, and it is like Rabbi Huda said, is larger than a kebetza, ha stomach kebetza, implying that a regular kesevis, who says the kesevis? We're talking about in the Mishnah, in Beitza over there, is the same as the kesevis agasa of our Mishnah. Here it says kesevis agasa, a large date. There it's just saying kesevis. So maybe, in other words, a kesevis agasa, fine, could be larger than a kebetza, ha stomach, but a regular kesevis could be kebetza, could be like the size of a beta, or Tosfos's girsa is that maybe that a regular kesevis is a little less than a beta. So Reb Zvid, so we could say Reb Zvid is talking about a regular kesevis, but that's not what we need as far as Yom Kippur. For Yom Kippur, we need a kesevis hagasa. That would be like Rabbi Huda says, larger than an egg, but a regular kesevis would be slightly smaller than an egg. The inami kiyadodininu, or even if you said that a kesevis and an egg are the same size, no problem. But you could say that the Mishnah is using one of them. It picked one of them instead of using kebetza. It used kesevis. The machshin had thought it's more likely that we'd use the word kebetza because we use the word kebetza so much more often. But the answer is you don't necessarily need that. They could just as well use the word kesevis if they're the same size. So there's no solid proof from there that a kesevis hagasa is in fact smaller than a kebetza, because maybe a regular kesevis is smaller than a kebetza, or maybe it's the same size, whereas a kesevis agasa, which is what our Mishnah is talking about, is larger than that. Rather, Rav Zvid is going to get his proof that a kesevis agasa, which is what we need for Yom Kippur, is smaller than a kebetza. He's going to get it from a different source. A Mishnah says in Brachas, ad kama mezamnin, up to what amount, what's the minimum amount that a person has to have eaten in order to be included in a mezuman? Ad kezayis divir a meir. A meir says only if he ate a kezayis. Rabbi Yehuda ima ad kebetza. Rabbi Yehuda says he has to have eaten a kebetza. In other words, the point is, according to the meir and Rabbi Yehuda, respectively, that's the minimum amount that you need to be chayav invention. Tosfos Anam Aleph talks about that all that would only be drabbanon. Daraisa, a person would be chayav invention only if he ate enough to be satisfied. Which has implications in halacha, by the way, if a person is going to be moti somebody else with benching, and one of them ate only a kezias, and the other one ate kedei sviya, then he can't necessarily be moti him because the first one is chayev only derabbanan, and the second one is chayev daraisa. Anyway, so b'may kumriti. Now, what's the underlying machlokas? Why a kezias or a kebetza respectively? So like this, Reb Meir Sava v'achalta zu'achila. Reb Meir says like this, when the Pasuk says v'achalta v'savata v'erachta, means v'achalta zu'achila. The word v'achalta means the normal amount that the Pasuk continues eating, namely a kezayis. V'savata zushsia. The word v'savata includes also when you drink, that you have to make a bracha achrona, if you drank a certain minimum amount. V'achila v'kezayis. Well, the word v'achalta, as usual in Torah, when it says to eat something or not to eat something, it means a kezayis. Therefore, once the person ate a kezayis, he was mekayim v'achalta. Rav Yehuda, and now again, according to Tosfos, all this is only an asmachta, because it's rabbanon, but fine. Rav Yehuda sava v'achalta v'savata. Rav Yehuda put the words v'achalta and v'savata together. He says it means achila sheyesh v'sviya. It means it has to be the kind of eating that fills you up. V'ezezeh kebetza. Namely, that would be at least a kebetza. So now, says Rav Zvid, the sakadaydach kesevis agasa sh'omru yisedim kebetza. If you're going to tell me that the kesevis agasa of our Mishnah is larger than a kebetza, hashta kebetza sabui misaba, let's consider a kebetza is enough to even fill you up, because we're saying that would already be the sabata, according to the Yehuda. Gaita lemiyasa. You're telling me it wouldn't take the edge off a person's hunger? If we said before with Yom Kippur, the point is not that you eat, the point is that you don't feel hungry, that you don't feel the affliction of hunger on Yom Kippur, then for sure, if we're saying that a kebetza is enough to even fill you up, then for sure that's going to be enough to take away the inui. So therefore, obviously, it must be kaseves hagasa shamru pachas mikabeitza. Therefore, obviously, the kaseves hagasa must be less than a kabeitza. Therefore, kabeitza misaba. So what it is like this: if you eat a full kabeitza, you're going to feel full. Kaseves, but if you eat a kaseves, which is smaller than that, miyas v'daite, then that will be enough at least to take the edge off his hunger, and that he won't feel afflicted anymore. So that is, in fact, the halacha, that that a kaseves is considered to be less than a kabeitza. Again, you get into the question of whether we mean a kabeitza with or without its shell. You also have a relevant thing as a gemara in Krisus that implies that a kaseves is the size of less than two kazesim. So all told, the Rabbi Avraham Chaim Noah writes in Shiurei Torah, he summarizes as follows. If we take the view that the egg that we're talking about over here is without its shell, which is going to be, again, a considerable amount smaller than an egg with its shell, and you take also into consideration that business in Krisus about it being the less than the size of two kazeisim, and you figure out the size of a kazeis relative to a kabeitza, which you have different opinions among the poskim whether a kazeis is half a kabeitza or whether it's about a third. So it comes out therefore that we have to consider that a kaseves might be no more than two thirds the size of a kabeitza. So he calculates to be on the safe side, to consider in case you have to measure the egg without its shell. So he comes up with a figure of 30 cubic centimeters of food, which is, in other words, if you have to feed a person, if a person has to eat on Yom Kippur, and the din is that in that case, you try to feed them, pachas mikashir, you try to feed them a smaller amount at a time, and only if that doesn't work, do you feed them a full amount, as we're going to talk about later in the perek. So then what you do is sort of Avraham Chaim Noah calculates the ideal amount to feed him would be 30 cubic centimeters, which is about just over an ounce. If you can't manage with that, then you can do 38 cubic centimeters, which comes out to about an ounce and a quarter. And I think he may also mention a possibility of maybe 48. I think he also maybe mentions a shear of possibly 48 cubic centimeters, which would be about an ounce and a half or an ounce and two thirds or something. But the ideal is to give them 30 cc or less, which would be about 1 ounce, which would be, let's say, the amount of food that would fit in a kelishkol. And that would be, ideally, if you have to feed somebody on Yom Kippur, or a person themselves has to eat on Yom Kippur, that would be the amount to eat at a time, and then wait to de'achilas pras, which is, again, you have different opinions about that among poskim, and then eat again. If that doesn't help, if that's not going to be enough for the person, then you feed them more than that at a time.
Kovetzet hagasa, how much bigger than a kovetzet, a regular kovetzet?
Kaseves. So that's we don't know for sure. Based on the Gemara over here, the previous part of the Gemara, it might have been that a regular kaseves was smaller than a kabeitza, and a kaseves agasa is larger than a kabeitza. But now we ended up saying that no, even a kaseves agasa itself is smaller than a kabeitza. And again, how much smaller? The possibility is it may be no more than two thirds the size of a kabeitza. So how much a regular kaseves would be compared to that? It doesn't say. I mean, it's not really negei la'alocha, because as far as Yom Kippur, we need kaseves hagasa. As far as chometz on Pesach, the halacha is like this hilul anyway, that a person is over on Ba'yura or Ba'yimotza with only a kazayas, not a kaseves. And we don't really have, because a regular kaseves is not really used in other areas of halacha.
Why is it used just for Yom Kippur?
So that's what we talked about, because the Chachamim figured out that only if a person eats kaseves hagasa is that going to take the edge off their hunger, and now they're not going to feel hungry, and they're not going to feel the affliction of Yom Kippur anymore. That's what we're going to continue discussing that point tomorrow, Beis Hashem, and talk about. I mean, how does that work? Don't different people have different amounts of appetites? We're going to talk about that.
Number one, and number two, we could have used a kazais to express the same opinion.
Kazayis is not enough. If a person eats a kazayis, which is smaller than a kaseves, he's still going to feel hungry. That's the point.
Well, then we could have said a kazayis and a half, or kazayis and a third, or something like that.
Once you pick that, then it's better to use one kind of fruit, which is more easy to measure with. I mean, listen, you know, if they had modern measurements in the times of the Gemara, then they would have said it in terms of grams or ounces or what have you, you know. But they didn't have standardized measurements, so the best they could do was tell it to us in terms of various kinds of fruits or other natural objects. But to start saying kazayis and a half or something, it wouldn't really be any easier to figure it out that way. The way you figure out these things, al pi halacha, is, for example, let's say a kaseves hagasa. Once you have a fruit, which let's say you've established that this is a kaseves hagasa, the way you do it, the Mishnah mentions in Kalim, is the way the Mishnah says it in Kalim is you take, for example, a larger kaseves and a smaller one, you drop them in water, you see how much water comes out of the container, and then you split that, and then you have the shiur or the ab. Well, that's for an average size egg, actually, the Mishnah says. So similar idea over here. You take the largest kaseves you can find, you drop it in water, you drop it into a full cup of water, see how much water spills out, measure the volume of that water, and there you go. You're gonna start doing that with a kazayas and a half. That's not really any easier. So therefore, much better to say the shear in terms of one whole fruit.
Shkayach.
Okay. Shkayach, Rabbi. Thank you. A wonderful day.